away, I make extra money. Still tell me to make every year. Okay.
Hello.
Okay. I want to talk, it's a little bit early to talk about Yom Yerushalayim. I'm not going to be here towards next week. I won't be here. Mitzvah shall be in the States for Yeshiva stuff. Yom Yerushalayim comes out this year on a Sunday, so it's really, we hit it right after Shabbos. I do want, through you, to stress the importance of trying to be involved in the Yom Yerushalayim activities, in particular, davening with Deacon at the Kotel. I mean, it's just one of the highlights of the year, the whole Yeshiva together, the Rosh Yeshiva. And this is a little bit easier because it's really a two-day Yom Yerushalayim festivity because of Shabbos, so most of the country is going to celebrate Yom Yerushalayim on Sunday night. So a lot of the non-Yeshiva activities will take place Sunday night, but the Yeshiva is going to celebrate a Moshe Shabbos beginning of the Sunday, so you really don't have that conflict. Should I be part of the Yeshiva events? Should I be part of some of the national events that you'll hear about? So obviously you want to make sure you're in the base matters also, but what I want to talk with you about is not how you schedule that. I'm sure you'll find out all the scheduling availabilities, but what are we really celebrating, and how to wrap your heads around Yom Yerushalayim. And I hope that some of the things I discuss for Yom HaTzmaut and Yom HaZikaron were meaningful, but at least Yom HaTzmaut is a day that you really did have some awareness in Chutz La'aretz. Yom HaZikaron, perhaps you had awareness, it wasn't as potent as it was here. I imagine that in many cases Yom Yerushalayim is just noted, you say hallel, maybe a falafel for lunch, or something of that ilk, but to really latch onto what the day means, and what they need in Eretz Yisrael. And to a degree, it's interesting because sociologically, Yom Yerushalayim is obviously not celebrated or marked by Charedim. It's also very, very infrequently celebrated or marked by Chilonim as opposed to Yom HaTzmaut, because in part because of the politicalization of this day and the events. It's really only a very small sector of society that really is aware, or aware of it, acknowledges and embraces and celebrates it, and you know, that's fine, obviously. There are reasons on both ends, but it's a day that has become much more infused with the Dati Lumi spirit. I want to give you three different dimensions to Yom Yerushalayim, to be able to think about it from three different standpoints, three different vantage points. The first vantage point, and to me the major thrust, and it's harder, and as time goes on, this becomes a little bit more dim in the rearview mirror. Excuse me for the typo on top of the page, should be Yerushalayim. It's just simply to be able to appreciate the Nisim and the Niflos that took place. Without thinking about the symbolic importance of Yerushalayim, how the world changed in 1967, things that I'll get to. And like I said before, it's this aspect that the passage of time dims, and it's also this aspect that's not just obscured by the passage of time, but is almost vandalized. It's disfigured by political revisionism. Where are the extra sheets for guys that are coming along? Thanks, Fama. In the rearview mirror of a political revisionism, the Six-Day War is cast. What happened? What are we? We're 45 years, right? 45 years from the Six-Day War. Right? 45 years ago, it was cast as if that's when it all changed. That's when Israel became occupiers. That's when the West Bank challenges began, that we had to rule over a people and solve the way to draw borders. And it's so unfortunate because in its truth, in 1967 was a miracle of unequal proportion in many respects, even unequal by 48. In 1967, let me give you a little bit of background. General Nasser, the general of Egypt, the ruler of Egypt, hurled the UN out of the Suez Canal. He evicted them from the Suez Canal. And he hurled his famous threat at Israel. And to us, it's cartoonish. You've heard the threat. You maybe even saw cartoons about it. But 67 was 19 years after the founding of the state. And those intervening years between 48 and 67 were not years of political stability, military safety, constant wars of attrition, constant terror attacks across the border from Jordan. Remember, the border with Jordan was a hot border, unlike today where that border is a Baruch Hashem, relatively safe border, constant fighting, skirmishing, small wars, small clashes, a lot of people lost their lives, not to mention people that sacrificed just to get to Yerushalayim, was taking your life into your own hands, about that little corridor on the way up to Yerushalayim. And economically, not to mention those economic years, I mean, I'll say something you probably didn't even learn about or study. These were years of economic rationing. You couldn't buy food, you had to have it rationed, like during wartime, like during military rule. Diplomatically, we're very isolated. This is before the United States poured significant weaponry into the state of Israel. And General Nasser gets up and announces that he's going to hurl the Jews into the sea. That's the famous, famous image. I'm going to throw the Jews into the sea. That resonates very, very deeply with Holocaust survivors 19 years after Hitler's Holocaust had ended, or 22 years afterwards. It's, you know, we're looking at time sweeps of 40, 50, 60 years. You're looking at 20 years after the Holocaust, and when we're defenseless and vulnerable and threatened to... I mean, Rav Amital Zichron Levracha would speak to us about these events every year in Yom HaShoah. It's actually an 18-minute Hebrew recording. It's up on the internet. There's an educators conference in Israel in a few days, and they wanted to hear Rav Amital about Yom HaShoah. So the yeshiva is preparing some of his... This is one of his famous Zichron. He just tell us the events, having lived through it. He says he remembers living through the events and the pessimism that abounded, the fatalism almost. Women and children were sent out of the country en masse. Women and children were sent to the United States, were sent to Britain, so that whatever casualties would be inflicted upon our people, at least the women and children won't be slaughtered en masse. That's what people were expecting. Kids would come to school weeks and weeks before the Six-Day War broke out. And there was no classes, no courses, no tests, no instruction. They were open to tell them. It would take them 5-6 hours and go home. That's the type of panic and the type of fear that ruled over our people and our country. People literally feared. I wouldn't say a Holocaust, because I think most military generals were game planning, hopefully. I mean, you know, military general's job is to game plan for whatever scenario is, remote as it is. You know, you don't try to think realistically, you try to think out of the box, so that in the heat of war, you've got plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D, plan E. But you don't have the time to think about different plans. You want to think about every possible crazy scheme scenario, have them all worked out, so then heat of battle, oh, this scenario is unfolding, let's implement plan A, let's implement plan B. The Israeli generals, in their wildest moments, in their wildest dreams, didn't imagine liberating Yudan Shomron, liberating the old city, marching into the Kotel, like in their wildest machinations. It never dawned on them. This was a defensive war in the truer sense. All their time was occupied, the weeks leading to this war. How can we escape with limited casualties? 30,000, 40,000, 100,000. How can we limit the casualties? In their wildest dreams, unfortunately, that's why the West Bank and Yudan Shomron have become such a political hot potato, because no one really knew what to do with it. There's nothing that anyone dreamed of. If not for Ariel Sharon bringing a few bulldozers to that small little alley in front of the Kotel overnight and leveling it and creating the plaza that we now have, that would also be under debate and international pressure. Ariel Sharon seized the moment and he just brought the bulldozers, but everything was stalemated because no one knew what to do with it. It was completely unarming, completely surprising. No one had any plan in place. That was the orientation. Send women and children out. Say to Hillam, how can we limit the casualties? There were no bomb shelters. People didn't even have bomb shelters in Tel Aviv. People would just go down to the basement the first night of the war, hoping that when the Egyptian Air Force would carpet bomb complete streets in Tel Aviv with impunity, that whatever buildings would be demolished or pulverized, a few people in the basement would survive. Obviously, people on the main floors would die, would be crushed to death. But that was bomb shelters. Going to the basement, maybe if you're in a 10 out of each building of 200 people, maybe we'll survive in the basement. That was the regnant attitude the weeks leading up to the Six-Day War. And then all of a sudden, people just went to those basements the first night of the war, and it's just miraculous, out of nowhere. They woke up to hear a crackling voice of the Israeli radio announcing there's no longer an Egyptian Air Force. The Egyptian Air Force has been completely eliminated. You no longer have to fear for aerial attacks. There is no longer an Egyptian Air Force. Israel surprised attacked the Egyptian Air Force on the tarmac. And all of a sudden, as the war unfolded, and again, this was pre-American assistance, and pre-73 was driven by the weaponry and the arming of our people in a larger Cold War geopolitical dynamic. This is just, you take a look and you read the psukim, you know, the psukim in Malachim Beis, and I'm almost crying when I hear these psukim, because I can't forget Rav Amital reading these psukim to us. Look at the first source. It's really the only source on this section. In the 15th year of Amatzia ben Yoash, as you know, the Jewish kingdom was divided in two. The north was ruled by the 10 Shvatim, capital was Shomron. By and large, wicked kings, the southern kingdom, Yudam ben Yamin, capital is Yerushalayim. So Matzah ben Yoash has already been ruling 15 years for Yehuda. The northern king is Yeravam ben Yoash. He's the northern king. He ascends the throne. Now don't confuse Yeravam ben Yoash with the nefarious Yeravam ben Nevat, the one who was an idolater, a paganist, and a murderer. This is a different Yeravam ben Yoash, but look carefully, the pasuk affiliates his behavior. Source number Aleph, line 2, Vayashara ben Hashem. Yeravam ben Yoash was just as wicked, just as disobedient. Losar, line 3, Mikol Chatos Yeravam ben Nevat. He was just as his administration maintained all the policies of Yeravam ben Nevat. So basically you're dealing with a Yeravam ben Nevat personality. So what happens during the reign of this wicked king in the north? Huay Shiv, line 3, Eskevu Yisrael Minavah Hamas Ad Yam HaRavah. He led to grand territorial expansion. All of a sudden Israel's borders extended until the Mediterranean Sea. Kidvar Hashem, I think we need another sheet up here, Shlomo. Shlomo, we need another sheet. Kidvar Hashem, as Hashem had prophesied, Asher Diber, Biad Abdel, Yonah ben Amitai. Thanks, Ezra. Just one sheet. As HaKadosh Baruch Hu had prophesied to Yonah ben Amitai, Hashem Migat Hefer. Yonah ben Amitai lived during this period. He was contemporaneous. Look at what's happening. A wicked, evil, disobedient, paganistic, perhaps murderous king. Yeravam ben Nevat was a murderer. We don't know that about Yeravam ben Yoash, but there's an equity, there's an equality here. The Tanakh's equating the two. All of a sudden, this wicked king is leading to grand territorial expansion to the Mediterranean Sea, as God had prophesied. Why? So the pasuk continues. Ki ra Hashem esani Yisrael marem me'od. Hashem saw the plight of the Jewish people was bitter. The Ephes Atzor, no one to stop invasion. Ephes Azuv, no one to help. Ein ozer li Yisrael, no allies. V'lo diber Hashem limchos Hashem Yisrael mitachas Hashemayim. And Hashem refused to allow the Jewish people to be exterminated. Rav Amital would always quote these psukim to us as a gloss for what's happening in 67. 67, we had no allies. 67, the UN was evicted from the Suez Canal. 67, America didn't rush to our defense. 67, we were literally on the brink of extinction. 67, he hurled that threat to throw you into the sea, and it was a threat that resonated. The gallows humor of 1967. I still remember hearing this joke, so to speak, this gallows humor. When I showed up in this country in 83, what was the line, Josh? You see him laughing?
The last one out of Ben Gurion shut the lights.
Right. The last person to leave Ben Gurion should shut the lights. You know, the last person out of the house, make sure the lights are off. That's what people fear, that it would come down to the last Jew leaving Israel, just make sure you close things up before you leave our country. That's what people feared. And we had no allies, and our predicament was vulnerable and indefensible. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, in 6 days, images and dreams and visions of Hayinu Kacham, we could only imagine dreaming about. We're no longer threatened by the Egyptian Air Force. You know how desperately Israel pleaded with King Hussein of Jordan not to join the war? We're fighting the Syrians to the north and the Egyptians to the south. We have no beef with you. This is not your war, King Hussein. Don't attack us. You won't be attacked. We're too busy. This is not an issue with you. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, General Nasser, whose divisions are being surrounded in the Sinai by Israeli troops, sends a telegraph to King Hussein saying, our Egyptian tanks are marching on Ashdod and on Ashkelon and on Tel Aviv. Come join the war. Open up a flank to the east and you'll join in the spoils of war, and we'll give you some of the land of these Zionists. A total lie. Total fabrication. Egyptian divisions were not marching on Ashdod and Ashkelon. They were being defeated in the Sinai desert. And somehow that day, the Rabbi Shalom intervened in the heart of King Hussein, as he does, Asher Salalti bin Mitzrayim, and Hussein is duped by General Nasser. And he jumps into the war, and just within 2-3 days, simply unspeakable visions. Har Habayis Biadeinu, HaKotel Biadeinu, blowing shofar at the Kotel, soldiers going down to the Kotel, the heartland of Jewish history, Beit Lechem, Shechem, Hebron, Beit El. This is where Jewish history unfolded. Jewish history did not unfold on the coast. This is where the Akedah happened, where Avram traveled to. This is where we live. This is where Jewish history was hatched and born. You don't even imagine returning to these lands. It was the furthest things in people's imagination. This is a defensive war. And that's really the first type of experience to try to tap into. Before you talk about the symbolic meaning of Yerushalayim, how the world was changed after 1967, simply needs some influence. There are people, not too many, but there are people and there are shittos that say you should not say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut for whatever reason, that I don't want people getting wrapped up around that issue. You could be the biggest Zionist in the world and not say Hallel because you feel that I'll be Allah, you shouldn't. And you could be, you know, in theory, someone who's an anti-Zionist against the state and but still feel that the needs are great enough to warrant Hallel. People get so wrapped up around the formal question. Oh, forget the formal question. There may be halachic issues, and everyone deals with halachic issues differently. But just to show you the different dimensions of Yom Yerushalayim, there is a sheet there of Unterman, Zecher Tzadik Lebrach, who is one of the Rav HaRashi of Eretz Yisrael, who felt you should not say Hallel on Yom HaTzmaut. Remember, not say Hallel, not say with the Bracha, I forget which one, but whatever it was, you should say either Hallel or Hallel with the Bracha on Yom Yerushalayim, because the magnitude of Nisan that occurred was simply one that surpassed, that superseded whatever miracles, as significant as they were. The miracles of 48, I'll talk about this a little bit later, you know, they were a little bit flawed. They were UN brokered, you know, there's an armistice, basically no advance, nothing really changed, we just defended our positions. It was groundbreaking, it was historic, but the Nisan people really felt. You talk to even to secular Jews who lived during that experience as if Mashiach could have come. As if that was an era, that was an opening, that was a horizon, that was a window. And if somehow history had turned differently, 67 could have been the Yom Mashiach. Now we believe it could be Eschalta de Gula, but that's already a whole different arc. That could be hundreds of years, thousands. But it could have been an imminent return, and somehow history didn't evolve that way. But just to feel the Yad Hashem, and the Ashkacha Pratis, and just that people's lives were spared, not 10 lives, not 100 lives, but hundreds of thousands potential casualties. Zehayom, if you're able to say Zehayom Asa Hashem, Nagila V'nisma Chavo, there's a day that you're experiencing 45 years ago, in which thousands of years after Nevuah, thousands of years after Beis HaMikdash, thousands of years after Yitzias Mitzrayim, Zehayom Asa Hashem, Nagila V'nisma Chavo, that should mean something to you, and to a degree. The miracles that have taken place over the last 65 years, more or less 66 years, they're not as stark, they're not as bold, they're not as concentrated, they're not as pitched, but you calculate how many rockets have been fired on our people over the last 10 years, and rockets per casualty, I think you'll come to an extremely, Baruch Hashem, extremely, extremely, or terror incidents divided by casualties, right? How many terror incidents have been perpetrated on our people over the last 15 years? And it's, I don't want to say it's an amazing figure, Chalila Vachas, because it's a very unfortunate figure. Baruch Hashem, we have the sense in our presence here, not kol hakavod to everything we're doing, and to Tzavan, to our ability, and to our chayalim, and of course, but sense that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is constantly, constantly protecting, and Magen Avraham is still a Magen Avraham. So that's the first theme of Yom Yerushalayim. And again, you mentioned the Six-Day War. It's undergoing terrible historical revisionism as if it's an imperialist war, and that's what we conquer territories or liberate, whatever terms you use. It's totally, totally untrue. And you have a responsibility to yourself and those in the next couple of years you'll be with people that just don't cop this. Go on the internet, read about the war, listen to the reports, hear that footage, see that footage, hear that army report where they march into Yerushalayim. Had nothing to do with any pre-shot. Simply, HaKadosh Baruch Hu provided us with some mitziah, with some undiscovered and unplanned opportunities. Obviously, the second part of Yom Yerushalayim is the broader symbolism of Yerushalayim. What does it mean? What does Yerushalayim mean in our collective consciousness? Let me share with you a Gemara and a Pasuk, and then try to help you better understand this, because I think it's also... It's difficult for rationalists. It's difficult for pragmatists. We're all pragmatists. We're all rationalists. But your pragmatism, your rationalism can't come at the price of your messianism. And how do you merge the two? How do you become a messianist to believe you're part of a messianic arc and still take practical steps, but realize that sometimes it's not about pragmatics. Not all places are created equal. There's an interesting Gemara in Brachos. We're in Brachos this summer. Daf Mem Tesim et Aleph. How do you conclude the third bracha of So we know how to conclude it, Bonei Baruch Amavet, consistent, the rebuilding of Yerushalayim. But there's a different position. So let's see the Gemara Bracha source A, part 2 source A. Ma'u chosen mevinyan Yerushalayim. How does that Bracha conclude? Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yehuda, and Moshe Yisrael. There's a dissenting opinion. Rabbi Yosef Yehuda, you don't speak about the rebuilding of Yerushalayim. You speak about Jewish redemption, Jewish salvation, messianism. It's a broader stroke, a broader brush. Not speaking about Yerushalayim per se, but the general theme of Jewish redemption. So the Gemara is surprised. The Gemara is astounded. Amar le, so I mean, line number two, Moshiach Yisrael in Binyan Yerushalayim. Whoa! That's all you speak about, Moshiach Yisrael? Can you even talk about Jewish redemption without mentioning Yerushalayim? How could you even articulate a bracha that concludes with Jewish redemption without considering Yerushalayim? So right away, Rabbi Yossi reviewed the backpedals. No, 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 Ella Ema, Av Moshiach Yisrael, Chas V'Shalom, I would never conjugate a bracha about Jewish redemption without including Yerushalayim. And what I meant is, you don't just mention Yerushalayim and allude to Jewish redemption, you actually formulate Jewish redemption. The bracha should conclude, Bonei Yerushalayim, U'Moshiach Yisrael. That was Rabbi Yosef Yehuda's longer version of the bracha. We suffice with the shorter version of the bracha. Point is, you can't address Jewish redemption without factoring in a city, a place, a capital, a Beis HaMikdash, a center point, an epicenter, a stone upon which everything rests. The notion of Jewish people returning, even the notion of geographical return, has to be pinned on a place that bridges the two. And I'll get back to that pasuk in a moment, but let's take a look at source above, as I mentioned the metaphysical part of it. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Amar HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Lo Avol B'Yushalayim Shalmala, Ad She'Avol Yushalayim Shalmata. I will only resuscitate and rehabilitate Yushalayim Shalmala until first I will resuscitate Yushalayim Shalmata, Nechsev Yushalayim HaBnuyah, Yerushalayim is a city that unites the city. We'll talk about the other meaning of this fusion. Yerushalayim is a fusion. It's a fusion between humans and HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's how Yerushalayim got its name. You remember, there was a sect of religious people who already settled Yerushalayim before Avram ever arrived on the scene. Who was the head of that sect? I talked about it earlier this year. Malki Tzedek was this priest to Kohen Le'el Elyon. And what did he call that town? Shalem, because people realized that human beings could reach perfection through religion. They wanted to become more perfect. They wanted to improve themselves. Really, the first culture to look to improve themselves, not just geographically, like the people of Migdal Bavel, but spiritually and religiously. And he was a religious leader. He was a Kohen in Parshas Lech Lecha. He settles with his group, this group of monks or monasteries, and he builds a religious community of perfection, of striving for perfection. But what does Avram add? Avram adds to the word Shalem. What does he add to the site? The word Yeru. He visits that site in Parshas Vayera, and he introduces the notion you can't just achieve perfection by human convention. You can't just perfect yourself through human means. In order to be perfect, in order to be Shalem, you have to stand in front of Hashem, the Har Hashem Yiraya. You have to walk up to the Akedah, and sometimes you reach perfection not through human ration. The Akedah is not a human rational moment. You can't make sense of the Akedah and human morality. To reach full perfection, you have to stand in front of God, beyond human ability, beyond human morality, sacrifice, ways you can't understand, ways you can't comprehend, and that's the full perfection. Yerushalayim. He takes Malki Tzedek's name, and he conjugates it, Yerushalayim. So this Shalayim was always this conjugation, was always this combination between a human city and a divine temple in Shemayim. So there was this combination between what went on. Ein Zekim Beis Elokim, Yaakov says, V'zeh Shaar Shemayim. One knew that Yerushalayim, and all three major religions knew that that's where religion, monotheism, is going to emerge from. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I will not restore the heavenly spiritual input of this world until I first restore it. I won't resuscitate and repopulate my people until I rebuild Yerushalayim. Which is why we say every day in davening, source number Dalet, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem, Nidcha Yisrael Yechanes. I will build Yerushalayim and I will gather my exiled children. The two go hand in hand. Children of Israel will not be returned to their people and their homeland without Yerushalayim. The two are inseparable. And that's why, hurry back, so I want you to hear the second one. Hurry back. No. And that's why, and this is really the important gist. The events of 1967 were far more messianic in everyone's consciousness than the events of 48, both in the general universal consciousness as well as in the Jewish consciousness. When the Jewish people returned in 48, to their homeland. In everyone's view, this was, it was good for the world's conscience. The terrible crimes of the Holocaust had to be addressed. All these refugees had to be dealt with. The Jewish people were owed a moral debt. Anti-Semitism, in their minds, had to be repaired, and this would be a way to repair it by giving Jews their own homeland. Falsely, but that's what people believed. Messianism didn't really emerge powerfully in the human spirit in 48. This was just an accommodation. Jews have to be accommodated, let's parcel up the land, let's hand certain lands to the Jews, certain lands to the Arabs, let's have some rahmanis, some mercy, some pity on the Jews, refugees who are being ported from land to land. The return to Yerushalayim 19 years later is a messianic dimension. All of a sudden, when Jews return to their land, Jews have returned to the historical stage. We're living in Yerushalayim. We're dictating our own fate. We've returned to the land of history, not just to Tel Aviv, and to Haifa, and to Ashdod, and to Ashkelon, but to Yerushalayim and the broader Jerusalem area of Shechem, and Beit Lechem, and Hebron. And all of a sudden, these psukim and these visions, Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem, Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes, that's when the enthusiasm for Aliyah is kicked off. The Aliyah between 48 and 67, especially, not the Aliyah of stress, but the Aliyah of movement, not the Aliyah from Jews who have to flee from Arab lands, but the Aliyah of people who are coming from European and Western civilization. That's when the Aliyah started to gather steam. That's when Bonei Yerushalayim Hashem Nidchei Yisrael Yechanes. That's when people started to talk more directly about it, Reishit Tzmichas Geulah Seinu, about a redemptive nature to our people, settling our land, restoring our sovereignty. I said that before. I want you all to walk out of this year with all the other traits and attitudes and values. I want you to be proud to call yourself a seven. And unfortunately, in most areas today, that tag, that association, has unfortunately very, very negative and pejorative associations. Not just because you're a settler, doesn't mean you're racist, doesn't mean you're a fanatic, doesn't mean that you, Chalila Vachas, take advantage of other people's rights. And to a degree, there's a dilemma. I don't know the answers. My settler identity means that I feel that establishing sovereignty over my land is part of the redemptive propulsion. It's part of the redemptive process. Now, there's a problem. There are other people on this land, so I'm not going to compromise their moral or legal rights. But to me, living in this yeshiva, living in a lone shvut, I want that to be part of your identity and part of your pride. That you could say, I spent a year in the settlement, and when I come to Israel, I don't avoid the settlements. I dedicate money to settlements. I feel that's part of my commitment to Jewish statehood and to Jewish redemption, is commitment to Jewish sovereignty. Everyone has to define how much they invest in one, how much they invest in the other. Obviously now part of our challenge is not just to settle land, but to settle Jewish cities and go back to Haifa and to Tel Aviv and bring the face of Torah back to those who don't appreciate the face of Torah. There's so many dozens and dozens of needs that our people and our country have. So you may choose to invest in one because you feel that's a greater need. But not to be embarrassed and not to feel awkward, to feel like this is part of the redemptive process without coming across as racist. And to feel free, if you're on a college campus, to say, I am a messianist. I do believe that every centimeter of this land will be ours. I don't just conduct policy based on geopolitical rationalism, but I feel I'm a person of prophecy. But all that being said, I'm not going to take advantage of anyone's rights. I'm not going to shoot anyone. I'm not going to steal anyone. I'm not going to burn anyone's olive tree down. I'm not going to take anyone's land. To have that pride that you're part of a prophetic process. To be able to speak in clear terms, not as some crazy Taliban fanatic who's going to bomb people, or to be able to feel that pride and to be able to express that pride. I don't have to conduct my affairs solely on rational terms. And this is a historical process that I'm proud to be a part of. And this is not a participation that was extended to my ancestors. For some reason, Hashem chose me for inclusion. Hashem gave me that opportunity. And when I said that all of a sudden in 1967, redemptive fervor became part of the Jewish identity and the Jewish mind frame, it wasn't just the Jewish mind frame. The return of Jews in 1967 marked a messianic landmark for everyone. That's when Lahavdil, Christian fundamentalism, all of a sudden recognized that this was a momentous event, the return of Jews to their homeland, connotes for them whatever it connotes. 48 was a quiet return of a couple straggling refugees to accommodate a conscience of the world that was plagued by the Holocaust nightmare. When Jews return to Yerushalayim, history shifts into full gear. Messianism shifts into full gear. Jewish people have returned to the national and international stage. All of a sudden, all the prophecies of Achris Hayamim. And people have the sense throughout, there's a very famous, I'm sorry, I just wanted to make sure you got that point if you need to take a break. There's a very famous phraseology in Shir HaShir. Shir HaShirim, as you know, is a courtship between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his people. But there's a third voice in Shir HaShirim. There's the voice of the female lover, the Jewish people. There's the voice of the male lover, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But very often when the female lover is looking for the male lover, she turns to the Benos Yushalayim, to the people that are hanging around Yushalayim, these little girls in Yushalayim, have you seen my Ahav? Have you seen my uncle? Have you seen my lover? And sometimes the Benos Yushalayim are favorable. They help out. Oh, he went this way. He went that way. Sometimes the Benos Yushalayim and Shir HaShirim are very, very hostile. They'll hit the female personality in Shir HaShirim. So Chazal saw the Benos Yushalayim in Shir HaShirim as a metaphor for Gentiles, as a metaphor for the international community. Sometimes they're helpful, sometimes they're hostile. But the point is, why are the nations of the world referred to as Benos Yushalayim? Why is that the metaphor, the daughters of Yushalayim? So many other metaphors to refer to them as. Why are they called Benos Yushalayim? So it's a very famous medrash, source number 7. Davar Acher Benos Yushalayim, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Sometimes the word bas, a daughter, does not mean a genetic daughter, but it means a suburb. Because just like a daughter is a satellite, is an extension of a family, so to a suburb is an extension of a city. So you could call, I don't know, I'll try to break out of my cultural limitation. So you could call Hampstead Gardens, okay, a suburb of London. It's not really part of London, it's a suburb of London. Help me out here. You could call, what would be a suburb of Johannesburg? Any help here? Right, Glen Hazel. Well, that's part of it. Maybe Sandton would be a suburb of Johannesburg. And you guys can fill in the blanks appropriately. Okay? So, Benos Yushalayim, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Sor 7. Asida Yushalayim le'asos mitrapolin b'chal ha'aretz. The epicenter of history will become Yushalayim. And all the other cities will become Banos Yushalayim. All the other cities will be satellites, suburbs of Yushalayim. So anyone that's living in Beijing or Tokyo or Moscow or London or even Sydney or even Cleveland, they're really Benos Yushalayim, because even though they seem to be urban centers, commercial centers, cultural centers, they will one day all be suburbs of the real capital of Yerushalayim. So that's a phraseology to refer to people living all over the world. You are Benos Yerushalayim. Asida Yerushalayim Leos Metropolin V'shar Kol Haratzos Banos. And of course, it's a pasuk where the word Banos is used in Sefer Bamidbar, or in this case Yoshua, to refer to. So imagine that. Imagine whenever you step, wherever you will step, in Toronto, in New York, in Perth, in Auckland, wherever you will, they step, these big city centers, realize you're really just living in a suburb. Because one day the real center of history, the place where history will go down, is the same place it all began, Yerushalayim. And everyone knows that, and that's why Yerushalayim is so contentious. That's why whatever deals may or may not be agreed upon, it's always going to fall upon Yerushalayim. It's always going to be because in the subconscious and the unconscious of an entire international community, everyone knows that Yerushalayim, some recognize it, some don't recognize it. Everyone knows Yerushalayim is the center point and the end point of history. Everything else is just a sideshow. Everything else doesn't mean you shouldn't be part of those sideshows. But this commitment to Yerushalayim, and that's why it has symbolic meaning beyond just practical meaning. And that's why if you were sitting at a table and you had to pull the trigger on whatever piece of core, which obviously right now is ludicrous because we're not even close to it, but in some theoretical world, let's say people would be willing and it really came down to Yerushalayim, it'd be an easy matter. It wouldn't just be a rational, pragmatic choice that could save lives. The whole process isn't rational. But in theory, even if you're a rationalist and you feel, well, I'll give up land and I'll make sacrifice, I'll make compromise to save lives, Yerushalayim is not a rational factor. It's not a rational variable, because when you give up Yerushalayim, it's almost as if you give up the redemptive process. Maybe you say, look, maybe we're just not privileged for redemption. Maybe to save lives we should. But it's a whole different dimension. It's a whole different experience, a whole different question. The famous Yushalmi, Rav Amital would always quote, I want to make sure I get to the second part, but I just want to make sure you hear all the ideas Rav Amital would express to us about the people in Yerushalayim who used to write letters to the Jews in Alexandria. And as you know, in the early part of the first millennium, right after the Churban Beis HaMikdash, So Mitzrayim was really a cultural center of civilization, and the largest city in Mitzrayim was, of course, Alexandria, and they had a really large Jewish population. So the people in Yerushalayim would write a letter to the Jews in Alexandria, source number Chesed, so you shall me, Ha'ibnei Yerushalayim Kosvin Yerushalayim HaGadola Le'Alexandria HaKtana. They would write a letter from the large city of Yerushalayim to the small little outpost, the small little homestead of Alexandria. Now, in rational empirical terms, that was farcical. There were hundreds of thousands of people living in Alexandria, and Yerushalayim was barren. How many Jews were really living in Yerushalayim? But the sense that you just don't measure population and size of cities based on how many people are living there at that moment, or how large the construction and skyscrapers are at that moment, but you have a prophetic sense of. And the truth is, I'll tell you a very, very scary masara. There's a very scary masara that the Sma, it's one of the Svarim written on Shulchan Aruch, quotes, that the Jews of Germany go back all the way to the first Beis HaMikdash, something that historically we wouldn't assume. When did Jews really land in Germany? And at some point they migrated from Spain, or at some point in the Middle Ages, but we don't really have record of Jews going to Germany after the second Beis HaMikdash, after Rome, but certainly not after the first Beis HaMikdash. Where did the Jews go after the first Beis HaMikdash? Babel. And the Arabian lands surrounding Babel, where they probably migrated from. But evidently Jews went to Germany after Golos Babel. Nebuchadnezzar routed Yerushalayim, and Jews migrated somehow westerly, not just easterly, and northeasterly. And 70 years later, Ezra sends a letter to the Jews of Germany, come back, we're resettling Eretz Yisrael, come back. And as you know, the Aliyah during the days of Ezra was embarrassing. Only 42,000 Jews returned, and there are explicit Gemaras which say that if most of the Jews had returned, that could have been Mashiach, that could have been the end. That would have been the end of history. But the reason the second Beis HaMikdash didn't succeed is because so few Jews returned. And what is the Gemara saying in Kiddushin? Anyone know why didn't the Jews return? What was the problem about moving to Israel those days? The economy was difficult and there was terror. That was why people didn't move back to Israel in the days of Ezra. So Ezra sends a letter to all the Jews, and some came and some didn't, but the Jews of Germany send back a very, very offensive letter. They send back to Ezra, you return to Yerushalayim, and we'll stay in Yerushalayim Haktana. We'll stay in Germany, which is Yerushalayim Haktana. And the Masara goes, this is a Masara written in Svarim, that because the Jews of Germany had the gall, not just to remain, as opposed to returning, but to actually refer to Germany as Yerushalayim Haktana, to use that phrase Yerushalayim about Germany, then the Jewish communities of Germany were fated to suffer worse throughout history than any other Jews. It's a scary, foreboding Masara. Because of that, they suffered worse during the time of the Crusades, 1096. All the Franco-German towns, Aspira, Vermeisa, Magens, we read about during Mikinos and Tisha B'Av, because of that, the Holocaust, obviously this was written before the Holocaust, but it's a terrifying tradition. It's one thing if you don't make Aliyah, basically. It's another thing if you lose the sense of Yerushalayim as this epicenter of Jewish identity. That's a whole different ballgame, it's a whole different cry. And that's why Chazal interpret the pasuk here, Shechubra LaYachav, it fuses us to metaphysical, messianic reality, Yerushalayim, redemptive reality. And that's the second layer. Layer number one, the Nisim Nirflos. Layer number two, the return to redemptive experience. Layer number three, which I think is the hardest for you to understand, okay? The sense of Nisim Nirflos, you can hear historical reports. The sense of return to redemption, I think, and I hope you feel it. But all of a sudden, the repercussions of what happened in 67 changed Judaism across the globe in ways that I don't think you appreciate without a historical perspective. One of the greatest events in the 66 years of the Jewish state, to me, if you ask me, one of the greatest, let's say, non-military events. Military events are obvious. They're stark. If you ask me, one of my top five events, to me, has to be the Russian Aliyah of the 90s. And it's important because of its impact on our society. I was here in the 80s. I can help you gauge how that changed our country. It basically propelled us from a borderline third world country to a superpower. I was here in the 80s. I don't have to tell you what my life was like here. I mean, I would go to the Makola to buy a bag of milk, because we didn't even have milk in yeshiva to buy their own milk. And a bag of milk cost, are you ready? 350,000 shekels on Monday. And on Tuesday, it was 370,000 shekels. Our economy was a joke. Our technology hadn't yet evolved. Today, we are a robust superpower. Militarily, educationally, culturally, economically. I have to tell you, I don't want to dance on anyone's misfortune. When I go back to the States, I feel a little different. I feel glad to be back in Israel. I feel the economy and then the country just works better. Seriously. When you look at the financial meltdown that's afflicted Europe and most of Western, Baruch Hashem, we've survived more or less intact. I hope it should continue. That's just Hashem. But you speak to Israelis here, and basically they use terms. I was in Ra'anana last year. I was like, hey, Ra'anana, maybe it's not an appropriate sampling. There are enough people saying the good life is now here. These were people that immigrated from Holland, where the Baruch Hashem Jews are very wealthy. People have a sense of what changed. A lot of things changed. And Derech Agav, I just want you to know that part of it is Shimon Peres, who takes a lot of flack for his political views, was responsible for two major events in the history of the Jewish state. Number one, anyone know? He developed the nuclear bomb for Israel. He led that team in the 50s and 60s that developed nuclear capability, which is, as you can imagine, a major, major event in the state of Israel. And in the 80s, when the economy just got too chaotic, he and a fellow named Yitzhak Modoy became co-finance ministers, and they reined in inflation. They were able to control inflation, which is not an easy task. But what really bumped us forward? In the 90s, if you're going to absorb 1.5 million high-caliber, educated people, it's one thing to absorb Ethiopians, it's one thing to absorb, and that's our moral responsibility, there's not one shred of racism here, but that's a financial strain, and it's a financial strain we should be taking, because they don't bring education, they don't bring a certain style of life that we want to create in this country, and unfortunately, we're still suffering socially. And unfortunately, they're still suffering socially. There's a large protest movement. The Ethiopians are spearheading for racial equality. Unfortunately, the suicide rate, the spousal abuse rate in Ethiopian society, the general social stresses. A lot of the girls who serve in Shavuot Lumi in national service will serve in Ethiopian communities where, because the cultures are so different, if you're an Ethiopian man and you're used to having two or three wives, and you are the ruler of the roost, the master of the mansion, whatever your mansion is, whatever you say goes, then all of a sudden you walk into a society where based on equality of genders, it's very hard for you. And it's going to put stress on your marriage and on your family. And the horror stories are terrible. And my daughters and others like them are spending, you know, hours and hours every day trying to rehabilitate the social fabric. But the Russian Aliyah, these were educated, scientific, enlightened, culturally advanced. Now, initially, the Israeli economy was thrust into cataclysm because you just can't absorb 1.5 million people, you know, 25% of your population in 1993 or 94. But ultimately, the recovery has been spectacular because that is our resource. Our greatest resource is not oil. Our greatest resource isn't gas, although we discovered gas, so certainly not water. Our greatest resource is human resources. And to take 1.5 million Russians into our country, they have dramatically, as much as we celebrate Anglo Aliyah, it's a drop in the bucket compared to the millions of Russians that have come. You go to any store in Ashdod or Ashkelon, you'll see Israeli signs, Arab signs, and Russian signs. You won't find English signs. The only English signs you'll find are in the Ra'anana, Modi, and Kashmir. But in the larger national equation, the Russian Aliyah has impacted Israel far, far more significantly in many levels than almost any other region-based Aliyah. Now, why am I describing this to you? Because the origin, the genesis of that miracle was 1967. I still remember in the 70s protesting outside of the UN for Russian immigration, for Russian prisoners, to allow Russians to have tefillin. You can ask Rav Khan about his going to Russia in the early 80s, smuggling in tefillin, smuggling in matzah, getting bullwhipped by a gun on Yom Tov because they didn't want to go into a train when the KGB evicted him. I mean, these are stories, you know, cloak and dagger stories. We lived through this. For 70 years, Judaism was extinguished by the Soviet Empire. No one, people didn't even know they were Jewish. They had no trace of Judaism. They were stripped from their families. They were sent to Siberia. I remember being visited by my Russian officer cousin, Yaakov, 1972, I feel like I was eating breakfast with Lenin at my table. Like I had no trace of Judaism. Well, I mean, it was our family, so we came. He came on official Russian business, so he came to our house for breakfast. Like, I thought it was, I was having breakfast with who knows what, some Russian, vodka drinking bova. I had no sense of Judaism. And what turned it around? It's one of the modern miracles. An entire people didn't even know they were Jewish. They heard the voice of America announcing in 67 the military triumphs of the Jewish army. They returned to the Kotel. And all of a sudden, like the firecracker, it thawed all these frozen Russian Jews. And that's when the protests started. And that's when the Prisoners of Zion began. And that's when Sharansky and all the others began their movement that led to this great miracle. It's all 1967. It's all 1967. 1967 was not a miracle that was limited to the military battlefield or to the meadows of redemption of the old city and of Hebron. It sent these shockwaves throughout Russia. And I want you to see that in this source. And then I'll talk about a shockwave that went to the west. Source number Yud. Ki'ir Shechubra Layachta, the city of uniting people. So he mentioned about the metaphysical fusion that unites Yerushalayim of redemption and Yerushalayim of the present. But it's another medrash. Amar Rabbi Yehoshua ben Levi, Ir she'osa kol Yisrael chaverim. It unites Jews. Jews that were so far. Once we are in Yerushalayim, once we have this pride, once we have our army, Jews that have been lost, that have been cast adrift out of the Jewish experience, we're now united, we're now fused, we're now recaptured. Ki'ir she'osa kol Yisrael chaverim. 1.5 million Jews that were lost to Judaism became members of the Jewish people, members of Jewish destiny. But it wasn't just a shockwave sent westward or easterly to Russia. And here I've been waiting a whole year to talk with you about this. I'm going to take a few extra minutes. Who's speaking after me tonight? Rabbi Blau, is he speaking here? Speaking here, so I'll have to be a little bit quick. A lot of times, people debate, what is modern orthodoxy? What isn't modern orthodoxy? I'm not going to launch into that debate. But even if you believe that modern orthodoxy is a sham, you go back and you see, so much that needs to be improved and leaves to be desired and stuff. If you lambast and denigrate modern orthodoxy, you demonstrate that you have absolutely no historical perspective. My Zaidi told me, then in 1919, he davened in the great big firm shul in Baltimore. And Baltimore was known in America as the big Torah city that all the Torah Jews came to. And he remembers davening in the firm shul in 1919 in Baltimore. And he remembers, he told me, he started a club. You know what that club was called? In 1919 in Baltimore, the big Jewish Torah town in the firm shul. Are you ready? He started a club. You know who was in that club? Two people. You know what the club was called? The Shomer Shabbos Club. There are two people in this whole shul in 1919 in Baltimore kept Shabbos. Because to keep Shabbos in 1919 in America, and certainly in London, and certainly in Australia, basically means you have to get a new job every week because it was a 6-day work week. There are jobs for Shomer Shabbos Jews. Zaidi told me, change jobs every. Orthodoxy in America was a joke in the 20s and 30s. And if you asked your average Jew on the street in the 40s and 50s, would Orthodoxy survive in America, let alone? It would be like you're off the wall. Orthodoxy in America? A couple of old fogies, a couple of old Jews from Europe who still like to learn Torah. But ultimately, I don't conform. Remember, the 50s was a great year of conformity. Watch television shows from the 50s. You'll see conformity, one social ethic, one way to dress, one way to be, blind trust in big government, blind trust in big business. I once was close with a big Rav in Eretz Yisrael. He since passed on. And he would always be uncomfortable with the fact that I learned in a Hesder yeshiva, that I was going to YU, and I would come into his house for Shabbos. He would look at me and say, "Where's your yarmulke?" And my yarmulke was pretty big. And he'd say, "It doesn't count. It's not a real yarmulke." He always like make fun of me and needle me. I always tried to be sweet, and I wouldn't be contentious argumentative, and towards the end of his life, Baruch Hashem, he was able to see that my Torah was serious also. But he was always very, very fanatic. Hesder isn't real, and YU isn't real, and you have to be in Panovich. And then I once met someone who says, a woman says, "Oh, you know that person?" I remember I got an aliyah in that person's shul in the States for my bat mitzvah. I said, what? You davened in that person's shul? He was the rav and you got an aliyah for your bat mitzvah. He's telling me, I'm not firm enough. And he gave out aliyahs in his shul. He was the rav to women for their bat mitzvah. Then I met someone else who said, yeah, I was the chazan in that person's shul when he was a rav in America. I remember we had a microphone for Sunday. I said, why are you in a microphone studying Yom Kippur? And he's telling me, I'm not firm enough. What's the point? The point is that orthodoxy in America was just dead. Moshe Feinstein in his famous tshuva, you can't open candles on Shabbos, you can't open this, you can't open that. If you read the real tshuva, he goes through a whole tshuva, and it's mutter, 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 mutter. And in the end he says, but even though al-pi halacha it's mutter, I don't want anyone to open candles on Shabbos because no one's keeping Shabbos, and we have to make a gzera to reintroduce Shabbos identity to the Jewish people. I said, what does it mean no one's keeping Shabbos? Then you look at the date, it's like 1928. No one's keeping Shabbos in America, 1928, whatever, 1938. Whenever he writes a tshuva, so he has to restore Shabbos commitments. No one believed that Orthodoxy could survive. And modern Orthodoxy basically saved Orthodoxy. Because it was a type of Orthodoxy that people could feel comfortable performing. You know, you eat matzah, but yeah, you don't have to eat a shear of matzah. Just eat as much as you like. You can be from, you can go mixed dancing, it's all right, as long as it's in the shul, it's part of the Jewish community. Seriously, it's safe Orthodoxy. And I was speaking to a friend, someone told me he used to live in Queens, whatever, in the 50s. And he went away for the summer to the mountains. And he came back, and he was pushing his carriage with his child in Queens. And everyone's giving him these looks, like, why are you pushing your carriage? He says, what do you mean everyone pushes carriages on Shabbos? Oh, by the way, while you were away for the summer, the Rav decided that it was about time that he told us about the Isser of Havaris Dalet Hamas on Shabbos. Because in the past, he didn't really want to tell us because no one would listen. There's no error. Everyone was just being with Al Shabbos and friends. But everyone decided to look the other way because otherwise everyone's going to leave their phone. We have to have mixed dancing Saturday night in shul because otherwise I'll be in the bars with the guy himself. So let's at least have mixed dancing in the shul or whatever. So we can't tell people not to push the carriages on Shabbos because no one's going to listen. And that summer, the Rav decided, now I can tell people that it's Asa Min HaTorah. And this poor guy, who was away from the summer, didn't get the news. So he's still pushing his carriage and was looking at it like, what are you doing? That's what Orthodoxy was. No one really believed. I still lived it. When I was your age, we didn't learn. No one was like excited about it. A couple old grease balls, you know, in the corner. These were the guys who called the nerdy guys, the grease balls. Those guys, they learned. But we didn't learn during the summer. We didn't have a learning program. What changed it all? What created this vibrant, robust, proud, Torah-centered orthodoxy that you grew up with, that is a product of the Hesder, that fuel people coming to learn? It all turned around in 1967. 1967 was the turning point. That's where Torah doesn't grow in a vacuum. If you don't have national pride, if you don't have a national sense of self, if you're not proud to walk around in public with a kippah on your head, you're not going to be proud to learn even in a quiet room. Torah is driven by Jewish pride. Torah is driven by Jewish identity. And that's part of the point when I feel people being very judgmental and accusatory of previous generations. It took more courage for your great-grandfather to keep Shabbos than anything you'll ever do in your orthodoxy. And it took more courage for your grandfather to wear a kippah in public than anything you'll ever do. And that's when it started. People in before 67, they don't want to keep up in public. You know, it's embarrassing. You don't want to rock the boat. You don't want to ruffle anyone's feathers. You don't want to be too divergent, too discrepant. All of a sudden, 67, we have our pride, we have our people, we have our land, we have our kotel. Am Yisrael Chai, Od Avinu Chai, Hashem's interested in our affairs, Hashem's interested in our needs. Slowly but surely, pride is restored, faith is renewed. People come back on the head, and all of a sudden we wake up and we're living in a period in which there's more Torah being studied than at any point since the first Beis HaMikdash in 3,000 years. That turnaround, I've lived through that turnaround. I'm not that old, but I lived through that turnaround. I saw it with my own eyes. I lived through the 70s where Torah was still recovering, was still smoldering, was still trying to get its breath. And all of a sudden this world that you live in, which is a given, Torah, it's a given commitment to Frumkai, it's a given. So my first message to you has nothing to do with the Yom Yerushalayim is, whatever you decide about modern orthodoxy, and you know I don't want you just to sign your name on the dotted line and believe that's the answer to all your concerns, because no movement is, certainly not modern orthodoxy. But whatever your feelings about modern orthodoxy, every single Jew learning in Lakewood and Mir today owes a debt of gratitude to modern orthodoxy. Because if not for modern Orthodoxy, I don't think Orthodoxy would have survived those terrible years. The question is, now you take it and move it forward and advance it. But when did that advance first generate its momentum? 1967. And that's what Chazal mean in that last source Yud, Ki'ir Shechubro Layachta. Every Jew, a Jew in Moscow and a Jew in New York City. Jews in Israel felt it most palpably because of the military salvation, because they stood near the Kotel and Shavuos with 400,000 people a few weeks after the Six-Day War, and a week after the Six-Day War. But a Jew in Moscow and a Jew in New York City, they were connected because Yerushalayim has that ability to connect the spirits of Jews. We have to stop because of the next year. But I hope you're able to take some of these images and really live them this year, and as I said to you on Yom HaSmut, and then live them to the future, even though those around you may not be aware or certainly not celebrating it with the same emotional intensity. Okay, let's stop for next year. See that all black and white of them walking through Yerushalayim, Moshe Dayan, and Bucky Bula. A lot of stuff out there. You know, if you can understand who's doing more stuff, just Google Yom Yerushalayim radio report.